Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, Rocky Thomas and Sean Lozinski join us today. Chris Tobin's with us, and we're talking about streaming and the little things that you need to do at the station to make sure your streaming is as good as possible. There's a lot of new capabilities, but they depend on the engineer getting things right at the broadcast station. That's coming up on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, saving, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the new Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/twrt. And by the Telos Alliance, shaping the future of audio, inspiring you to create the most exciting and engaging audio experiences imaginable. Visit telosalliance.com/opt-in.
Hey, welcome in, everybody. It's Kirk Harnack with This Week in Radio Tech, our weekly podcast. We talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower and lots of stuff in between. And it seems like there's more and more in between. Almost every week goes by and there's something else to think about, worry about, install or do, or a new procedure, new practice. And that's what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about some of the new practices, procedures, availabilities, ways to get content out to your audience or audiences that's been coming down the pike. And we'll get to our guests in just a second. I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance, and I'm back here in my usual home studio this week. Glad to be here. Also with me is our co-host, Chris Tobin. Chris, welcome in from the WBGO voiceover studio.
Why, thank you. Yes, it's a good day here at Newark. It's a great weather and everything's nice, and it's been a crazy week. We've been doing a lot of recordings, video, audio. It's been fun.
Well, good. By the way, we're having a pretty good heat wave here. We used to do a little quick weather thing. How's the weather there in New Jersey? Well, here in Nashville, it's about 93, 94, 95 degrees and humid. It definitely feels like summer. Could be hotter. It's still 10 degrees lower than it was a few years ago when it had a super hot summer. Chris, how's your weather there today?
Actually, today is very, very comfortable. It's drier than the last week has been. It's probably around 80 degrees right now. I think it was the high today, maybe an 85. But the dew point's in the 50% range, so it's been very comfortable. So it's good.
Yeah,
it's good.
That is nice. Yeah, we got dew points in the 70s, so it feels uncomfortable outside. Wow. I went for my morning walk today around the lake just down the road, and oh, man. I mean, I'm not even running or jogging. I'm just walking, and I came back all sweaty. I mean, I was glistening, so it looked like I'd been really running hard. So I made for a good selfie. Okay.
Yeah, that was last week. Yeah, we had that weather last week.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, Chris, you and I on this show, we talk a lot about streaming. We've done, introductions to streaming and different coding algorithms and why streaming is important and how, home speakers, smart speakers are important and why streaming to the car is important and a lot of the technologies. And because I work for Telos, so I'm kind of in on the coding algorithms, whether it's MP3 or AAC or any of one of the variations of AAC that's popular, and even the HLS or the multi-rate adaptive streaming. We've talked about that here on the show. And so our guests on the show today, let's bring them on in. We have here Rocky Thomas. Rocky's on our left here, and Sean Lozinski. Did I get that right, Sean?
Yes, you did.
All right. Rocky and Sean are here, and welcome in. Glad you're here. One of you, pick one. Tell us a little bit about your company, Media Creek, and then Rocky, you're going to fill us in on some business aspects that engineers need to be aware of, so they're part of the conversation, and Sean's going to fill us in on some of the deep tech about making these new features and functionalities work. So, what's Media Creek?
Absolutely. Thanks for having us. We're real excited to be here. Media Creek is a holding company of three other companies. One of them is Live365, which a lot of people do know. It's been around for about 20 years. We acquired the assets out of bankruptcy in December of 16, and we're in the process of relaunching the entire platform. Live365 provides end-to-end solution for broadcasters, microcasters mostly. And also, I think what makes us unique is that in addition to automation tools, we also handle 100% of the royalties aspect of it, which is ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, as well as RAAA. That's one of ours. And then also we also have another company called Empire Streaming, which is more of an enterprise level solution for broadcasters, everything to do with streaming. So it's an end-to-end solution. That means hosting, distribution, players, ad insertion, audio, ad serving capabilities and programmatic capabilities. And then we also have another company called Abovecast, which is more of what I would say hobbyist guys who want to utilize our vast CDN that's specific for audio to relay streams or to basically utilize them with their own type of automation system. So that's more of the DIY guy. So we've been we formed the company in December, and now we're about to launch a new entire podcast content management system here at Podcast Movement. And we're real excited about the entire industry and helping our broadcasters get online and make it a profitable business.
Wow, that is a great elevator speech. Now I feel like I understand Media Creek. And congratulations on picking up Live 365. That is awesome. Yeah. That you guys got the assets out of bankruptcy. That's terrific.
Yeah, it was great.
All right. Well, I suspect we're going to be talking as much about Empire Streaming as anything else, and what you guys not only offer for broadcasters, but Sean's going to fill us in on some of the technical aspects of all that. And I guess let's take a quick break and hear from our first sponsor. When we come back, Sean is going to be speaking, to us engineers. We're going to find out, some of the cool capabilities. Actually, you know, it might be better if we have Rocky first, kind of outline some of the cool capabilities that broadcasters can get from their streaming, that's good for listeners and viewers. And then have Sean tell us how that's done and what involvement the engineer needs to have. What does the engineer need to hook up and bring to the table so that the programmers and the station itself can get the maximum value out of getting out on the internet and getting out there the ways that the listeners want to hear it and partake of the content that's produced. Okay. So hope I've set that up. We're going to hear from our first sponsor and we'll be right back as we continue right here.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavvo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while, so why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavvo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavvo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavvo radio tech at www.lavvo.com/twert.
Thanks a lot to Lavvo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. We sure appreciate their participation here. So it's Kirk Harnack, Chris Tobin here, and we're talking with Rocky Thomas and Sean Lozinski of Media Creek. And as they outlined, Media Creek holds several other companies that have to do with streaming. And so let's talk about how this relates to broadcasters. And Rocky, if I could go to you again first. Talk to me about some of the cool things that, you know, if a radio station is fully taking advantage of what's available to them, what are some of the cool things that their listeners could experience in a full online experience? What are the benefits to listeners?
Well, I think the number one reason a lot of stations go online is because they want to be where the listeners are. With Alexa devices, with mobile devices, it's really the new radio transmitter of the day is one that's either in your hand now or it's on actually in your kitchen. So I think that we first need to address that it's cool just to make sure that they can listen to your station in a way that they like to listen. But as far as like new type of emerging kind of like listener technology that's happening is I think that the first thing that's near and dear to my heart, at least, is making sure that your metadata is correct and your now playing information is correct. There are so many times when I ask Alexa what song is playing, and she just tells me the radio station because they're only doing top-level metadata. And I think that's one of the biggest draws to having smart speakers is having that type of interaction. And when the interaction is not there, it kind of makes it not a perfect type of experience. But also, I think that a lot of people still like the basic stuff, which is seeing, okay, what played about 5-10 minutes ago because I want to know more about that artist. I think, you know, radio's strength has always been artist discovery. And the fact that in making that available to listeners to have that discovery, whether it's in a historical way or in an immediate way with Alexa is very important. I think that, you know, from a revenue standpoint for the radio stations is how do you really provide those type of different types of opportunities for advertisers? We all know that we have great online on-site presence with remotes, and we love having that high touch with our listeners. But I think also that, you know, really relevant advertising that speaks to your audience is just as important. And that's not just an ad pitch. I do believe that relevant advertising for listeners, it becomes a service. They want to know when shows are in. They want to know about new types of features that their favorite store might have. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of benefits to, you know, digital streaming. I mean, we've been doing this for about 20 years and we've seen the evolution of it. And I think that dynamic ad insertion just brings that up one level, a notch higher. So instead of doing one ad to many, you now have the ability to know that I get a different ad than possibly a male or somebody else next to me that might be a little bit more relevant and maybe even provide a better return on investment for advertisers, which I think is quite exciting.
So let me follow up on that then. I asked you about what's the benefit for listeners, and you know, it's just that experience making sure the metadata is there. And yes, that's really nice, and that keeps broadcasters and their streams on a par with the online music services that of course they built in metadata and album covers and things like that. But now let's talk about what's the benefit to the broadcaster who's putting the streaming on in terms of ad revenue. And as you mentioned, targeted ads so that the listeners feel perhaps more engaged with the ads than they would if they were not targeted. What's the benefit for the broadcaster?
Well, for the broadcaster, then they're able to really start to see an efficiency of CPM. We deal in a little bit of different currency on digital media. It's a cost per thousand. And so you're able to really make sure that every single spot is filled with a great ad. And so a lot of times is how broadcasters are utilizing digital media or digital audio today is that either they sell directly what they can. And I'm a big proponent of local direct sales. So selling directly at a high CPM to local direct advertisers. And then whatever is not filled is being filled with networks like our own. We have our own ad network called the Empire Audience Network. And what we do is we really work with broadcasters, not just to help fill their inventory that their direct sales has not filled, but also in an audio standpoint, but we also help them with video as well as display opportunities as well. So, and then also our company, so also helps local broadcasters with trafficking. Not everybody has an ad operations team, a digital ad operations team. And I know a lot of traffic directors that are always overwhelmed as it is just keeping the over-the-air product right. So Empire Streaming also provides managed ad op services that can really help a broadcaster get online with direct local sales as well. So you have direct local, which is always going to be what I call the meat and the highest CPM they're going to be able to get, which should be really the focus. And ad insertion technologies allow that to happen. That typically is more, not so much on one-on-one. It's really upselling that that client into a digital product. And then whatever the local direct folks don't sell, then it gets kicked over to what we call programmatic channels. And Empire Audience Network is one of those programmatic channels that they're able to then fill whatever they're not able to sell directly in a way. And I mean, and then there's also the whole idea of in and out of market. So there are some stations who simulcast in market because they want to take the benefit of the Nielsen total line reporting, which I think is a strategy. It's a numbers game. You have to figure out what a rating share is worth and how much of your listening is happening online and how well your sales team is selling digital locally. But if they are simulcasting outside of their metro, they're able to then monetize their out of market on the national scale where they don't even have salespeople, which is a really great benefit for local broadcasters.
Wow, you ran a few new terms by me there. They're terms I've heard before, but I'm still not exactly sure I know what they mean, but I want to hold that off until a little bit later in the show. Some of the benefits that you mentioned, and obviously metadata is a key one. We've talked about that here on this show before, but I want to get it from Sean now about what the local broadcast engineer needs to make sure is done. I guess, you know, really whether they're using one of your services or somebody else's, because everybody's got metadata. But Sean, let's imagine that a station signs up with one of your services, and it's going to be real important now to get all the metadata that they can or that's appropriate encoded into their stream. Help me kind of understand what that looks like and what that process is. And imagine I'm starting from nowhere, or I've been streaming, but just, you know, I was using some Shoutcast stuff and my buddy's got a server down the street and we were, you know, putting that link online and it was kind of a gobbledygook link. And now I'm going to go professional and I've never had metadata on before. I've got an automation system and maybe I've got a backup automation system. And then I've got some live programming. I've got a couple different sources that I'd like for, I guess, to show up on people's screens or on their radios or on their Echo when they ask what that is. So kind of, you know, consider me a newbie and what am I going to need to try to hook up to make metadata do what it's supposed to do?
All right. So, yes, metadata is pretty key here, in terms of being able to, you know, mark each one of our spots. And ad breaks in particular, and we want that to be precise so that it's not, you know, coming in too early or too late, and that, you know, it's seamless. Nobody can really tell we're replacing the ads. Now, in terms of how that metadata gets in there, that is usually sent from the automation system, and the automation system will then send that to the encoder. There are automation systems that have encoders built in, which is, you know, everything's pretty well built into there. You don't need to do too much. But in the case where you have an encoder that is a separate device or software, you would need to get that metadata over there. This is typically done, say, via UDP, an XML format. This and the metadata that you're sending artist, title, album, any other information that you could possibly send, say, like cat codes and IDs and things of that nature. So we can target ads when we get a cat code of com. We can even then say they only want these IDs to be replaced and not all of them. So we can then just replace those IDs. So then you also asked about, say, different automations are coming in live, et cetera. So one of the things, you know, depending on where that live feed is coming from and the metadata capabilities that they have, usually it's, if it's coming from another stream, that's easily sent over. We can also switch over the streams that they're pulling in, and we can be pulling that metadata from there. There are metadata middleware pieces that can slow down metadata sometimes. And the metadata can be tricky in the sense that we need to figure out why it's not precise or how we can fix it. And if we can't fix it, we do also have other capabilities to do that, say using tones or using jingles that we can trigger. And we also could do time-based, but that's not very good sounding.
You know, when we were talking earlier today, discussing what to talk about on the show, you guys did place a lot of emphasis on ad insertion and ad replacement. And I'd like for Rocky to explain that a bit later in the show. But for now, I'm beginning to feel like a radio station, when they're putting metadata in their stream, they need to think of themselves as like the network, you know, the originator of this programming. Yes. And somebody downline, you guys, are going to do something with that data. You're gonna cut my program off, hopefully in a really smooth place, and replace, my ads or my jingles or my IDs, whatever, with the way my imaging and my ads for my stream, maybe in market or out of market. Talk to me about, I mean, is that really what we're really driving at here, in addition to just title and artist information?
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of automation systems, or even that middleware we were talking about, it will remove any of the, say, station IDs, promos, mm-hmm. commercials, and all that type of metadata, which we actually need. And we have the ability to remove it if needed.
Okay, give me an idea of what that looks. What does it look like on my automation? Like, what kind of code is my automation sending in metadata to tell you guys, hey, this is where your ad goes? Is that a simple code of some kind?
Yes, actually, it can be as simple as you want. It could be whatever you want, really. We tend to say use like an ad trigger, and then give us in milliseconds the duration of the ad break. That doesn't necessarily need to be in there. But it does help in terms of getting the right number of ads for the ad break. It helps for inventory forecasting. It helps for a number of reasons. But if the automation system can tell me this is going to be a 15-second ad break, and then it tells me again in 15 seconds that I have another 15-second ad break, we can do back-to-back ad breaks, so we can configure it that way. We could say, if you just send me ad break, I could just say it's 2 minutes long, or I can detect for the next metadata update and things of that. There's a lot of different options to be able to detect that ad break.
So, I've been full of questions, and I'm sorry, I haven't even let Chris get a word in edgewise here, because Chris has dealt with, big city stations. I've dealt mostly with small market stations, typically my own stations, where, I don't know, we feel lucky just to get title and artist on most of our stations, right? Like, oh my gosh, we finally got that hooked up. We got the UDP port right, and we got this right and that right. Oh, how did that all work out? Oh, we had to get an expert in here, to do that. Because there's, it's almost like, going to a Baskin Robbins ice cream store, and there's 31 flavors to choose from, but there's also 31 different cones, and not every flavor of ice cream can go in every cone. My point is that it seems like automation systems are full of choices in how to send out metadata or how to make it available to be grabbed from them. And RDS systems or streaming encoders or middleware has all different kinds of ways that it can receive data or go grab data. And you got to get these two things to match up. And there's, like all these ways to do it, and there's only, two or three that'll actually work together. And so you got to find those ways. Chris, you've been listening patiently there in New Jersey. What, maybe you can describe your experience in the, maybe either the myriad of different ways, or maybe I'm just overcomplicating it and it's really, really quite simple. What do you think, Chris?
My experience early on was the 31 flavors and 31 cones, and only certain cones fit the flavors. Yes, we did have that happen. That was because certain automation systems just only worked on certain types of, I'll call them platforms. I think it's gotten much better, but I think part of the problem that I've run into working with several folks has always been, what are you doing with it, the metadata? How are you using it as part of your product? As mentioned earlier, it's all about the experience. And I've always said content's perishable is the most valuable. I've always said engaging the audience during your commercial break is just as important as the music, if you're a music station, or spoken word. So metadata gives you an opportunity to actually do something more. And I've seen so far, I'd say 80% of the time, broadcasters just take it as we got to do it, so stick a slide in there, whatever, during the break and let it go. And then they move on their merry way. And then they go back and do something else, and somehow it misses where it's got to go because nobody's taken ownership of it internally. So now you've got metadata capability and nobody taking ownership, and it's appearing ad hoc at different places. And folks downstream who are supposed to take this information and do stuff and manipulate it for you, you know, they're not getting exactly what they need. Because I've worked on a couple of systems where we did everything exactly the way we want. We set it up so that when that announcer hit the button for the break, we went to a break locally. We triggered a command that sent out a UDP packet for the automation so that the downstream folks could do their integration of dynamic ad insertion. We did everything like we're supposed to, only to find out that, oh, by the way, you have to do it within a certain window. Otherwise, we can't capture it the way you want to do it. Okay, why didn't anybody tell us that in the beginning? Those are the things that I've run into, which can be annoying. Now, I know there's ways to talk about it, but if no one has ownership of that metadata, what I call workflow, that's when I run into these issues. It's the strangest thing. Once it's made clear, whether it's a port, whether it's a UDP, you know, anything like that, that's just semantics. It's more of, what do you want to happen when I hit the button? In the case of a radio station going to break, what do you want that event queue button to do? And then getting someone to understand that has been my biggest problem. Because I just say, it's like, look, the person on air has no interest, nor should they, as to what happens when they go to break. They go to break, do their thing. That's it. Everything after that should be automated or follow some logic. And it just, that still, I think, is a big, big window of craziness that I've talked to folks with. Because on some shows I've worked on, internet shows that I've been asked to do some production or producing of, that's the one element nobody pays attention to. I ask them, okay, so we're doing this, this, and this. It's an internet stream, and you're streaming it on this network, and you're doing these shows. We're live on location. So what's your plan during these three sponsorship breaks that you have? What do you mean? Well, you're going to break away. So what are we doing? Because people are going to be listening to this or watching this, we've done video, on their phones, and you got into a sponsorship break. That's pretty much telling them, we're done, move on to something else in your life. I don't know. but literally that's what I've had happen. So you know, this is good. What you guys are doing, it makes total sense, and I like the approach you're taking.
So Sean, I've got a kind of follow-up question here. We talked about you know, the timing of this stuff, and I guess I remember, you know, within the company I work for, Telos, and you've talked to my colleague Ewan Roos. He's the guy that really does a lot of development on making our streaming encoders work precisely with the metadata that they're given. And I know that for another big CDN, we were working on getting the timing to be right within a couple of milliseconds, so that, you know, if we said breakaway now, it was going to break away right then, and resulting hopefully in a clean break from, you know, the radio station's programming to the ad insertion. But audio level has always been a concern too. Now, I started listening to online streaming many, many years ago, and back in the days when it was a big concern about not running AFTRA talent voiced ads, right, on your stream, because you hadn't paid for that. And I just remember it being a big deal. I worked for Scott Studios at the time, maker of automation systems, and we were selling, you know, parallel automations just to run cover ads. It was done that way back then. But the audio level was always a problem. And Sean, during our conversation earlier today, you just said that they actually have a method now for helping to even that out, to get the insertion ads to be at roughly the same volume as the station stream. Talk to me about that technology.
Yeah. So the way it's set up is basically when we bring them on, say a new station, the system is going to listen in for about a 10-minute period of time. It's going to get an average volume level out of that, and hopefully, you know, everything is pretty level. But if it's all over the place, it's gonna choose, you know, somewhere in the middle there, and you know, it will then every once in a while it'll go back and redetect that. Now we do have something that is basically listening in more so on into terms of like what the volume levels are, and it can adjust those ad volumes so that they're going to be playing within quicker period of time.
Yes. Yeah, so we don't have as much of a volume jump, and I realize that the ads, the insertion ads, they're not going to be processed the same way that the station's processed online. But right. you know, if they're processed less, which they probably are processed less, at least you know the overall volume can be brought up. So they kind of have the same you know RMS value in your ear, so you don't notice them being a lot louder, a lot softer. We'd like to keep them the same. In across my office, you can't see it here, but across my office, I'm looking at a 40-inch LCD screen display of my audio processing on my stream coming from our new station in Hawaii. And I'm watching this on an Omnia 9 processor. And of course, the input volume is just kind of all over the place. Song to, so you can tell, oh, this song played here, this song played here, this ad played here. Oh, the jock talked right here and he's way up here. But the output from this processor is really consistent. It's an Omnia 9, so it sounds good. It doesn't sound squashed, but the ultimate output volume is really consistent. And if your service took a 10-minute you know sample of that, it's going to be the same 10 minutes today, 10 minutes tomorrow, or 10 minutes 5 years from now. It's going to be exactly the same volume. And I guess my point in that, and I'll let you speak to this next, is that you really ought to do some audio processing on your streaming just to get you know your different levels from your automation system or from the live jock or whatever it may be to be in the same ballpark. They don't have to be a flat line. They don't have to be a brick wall of loudness. In fact, they probably shouldn't be for streaming. But they at least need to be somewhat consistent, and that helps listeners at home listen. It helps listeners in the car listen, and it helps your ads that are inserted be a similar volume. So I love the processing that my employer Telos you know puts into their streaming products. Tell me what you think about that.
Yes, I totally agree. The processing and or AGC levels, having something there to you know making that volume pretty consistent would be optimal. I don't, for streaming, I don't like, say, over processing it because, you know, if I feel like turning it up, I'm not just trying to fill the room. You know, you don't want to over process that, in my opinion. So, but then, you know, what I think I didn't really explain it that well, but in the past, we were doing the 10-minute chunk of detection, and then that would basically be when it first came on. Now it's happening within the hour that it's going to be listening in and detecting those ad breaks or not the ad break, but the volume levels.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So go ahead.
You get a little bit of trouble when sometimes engineers, they might play around with the gains a little bit. And so like I could speak to Aswiz Technology because we both used to work for Aswiz, and we are Empire Streaming, by the way, is a reseller of Aswiz Technology as well. So the way that it works is that we configure the actual ad zone. So that when we configure a station to go like a simulcast is that we actually we create a, so if it's a, if whatever it's streaming in, if we detect it, and when we upload ads into the ad server to be served, it's a perfect match, not only from an encoding, but also a volume level. I think the best type of compliment that we get is that you can't tell the ad is inserted because it just sounds like it's there. And I think that's what everybody should strive for. I remember the early days of ad insertion, was it the early 2000s during the after scares when we were doing my encoder, at the encoder level. And then everyone's like, oh, ad insertion sucks. Well, yeah, it did suck because the latency was horrible.
The volume levels
were crap. I mean, it was a bad years for ad insertion. And people and program directors were doing it because they were told to do it and because they're afraid they're going to get sued. I think what we've seen now, what makes me so excited is now programmers are understanding that it's a new reach for audience. And it's a new way of and so they're really paying attention to the quality of sound that's happening on their digital streams. I think that's really important because it was just such a poor product, like gosh, even 10 years ago. When we started doing server-side ad insertion is really where the whole jump happened, and that was around 2011, 2012. Before, we were doing it at the encoder level, and as you said, Kirk, you know, with Scott's, I remember when we were doing that back in like the late 90s, the split streams, I used to call it, where they would have, like, they'd basically have two systems running out of the studio, one for the digital and one for this, just so they wouldn't have those ads and be afraid. And just so everyone knows, no one has ever been sued by anybody in AFTRA. It's like the biggest scare tactic we ever saw, but you know, I guess it is what developed ad insertion technology, so I guess I have to be happy for it. But yeah, so I think that what you're seeing now is just a really better product in ad insertion. I would say that it really is hard to tell nowadays that ads are not being served locally and they're not part of the simulcast stream.
Okay. All right. Hey, so I got a couple more tech questions left, and then I want to ask about some language so that, you know, our audience, mostly engineers, can, you know, be at the table and really understand, you know, their corporate or their station's, you know, digital strategy, so they can help make that work as well as possible. I mean, that's what actually I've always thought that's what the show is all about, to help engineers have the knowledge and the tools that they need to fully participate with station management and station programming, so that, you know, they really work together cohesively and make the station as successful as possible. Because the engineer can make or break that. We sure don't want to break it. We sure want to help make it. So here's the couple tech questions. I'm going to set aside adaptive rate streaming in just a minute, because that's one of my favorite topics. And Sean, I think you like it too. But let's talk for just a second about just the basic algorithms. Is MP3 still a thing? And if it is, you know, where does AAC sit? My own stations, we stream exclusively in HEAAC V2, because we figure that about 48 kilobits is what we can afford to stream at. It works well for entertainment purposes for, you know, every device we listen on. I like it. No, it's not perfect. Yes, it is really good. And we do appropriate processing. So, you know, 48 kilobits to me, HEAAC V2 works well. But am I missing anything by not also putting out an MP3 stream? Sean?
Yes. So I would say MP3 is still very much mm-hmm. a thing. I would say it's a good portion of the online listenership is done via MP3. And, you know, AAC Plus, and as with any new codec, its challenge is going to be the player adoption. And, you know, everybody's phone plays an MP3. Everybody, well, more and more, they're starting to play AAC. And then you have AAC Plus, like you said, HEAAC V2. It will play as AAC, but if it has the secret decoder ring for the V2, it'll be able to do the spectral band replication, and it'll be able to, you know, give it a clear, better sound. And they say, what, 48K HEAAC V2 is supposed to be comparable mm-hmm. to 128K MP3. So there's definitely a bandwidth savings in there. But, yeah, there's still a lot of people that are listening via MP3.
That's interesting, because my household probably has a share of newer products than maybe some other households do. And in our decision to not stream MP3, and, well, not pay the money to stream, you know, more than one codec, mm-hmm. what I found is the only device – that I've ever found in my house, and I've got, there's 46 things attached to my Wi-Fi here in this house. The only thing I found that doesn't play my station streams is a TV set with built-in Roku in my son's bedroom. And if I put, you know, the TuneIn app on there and then try to play my station streams, it says, you know, the codec is not supported. But every other device that I've got, every single cell phone I've got, everything plays our stations just fine. So I don't want to have blinders on that if I'm not transmitting MP3, am I really missing out on a big audience? Now, you said a lot of MP3 is a lot of streaming is still MP3. A lot of people still listen to MP3, and I just wonder, what if people listen on MP3 because that's what the station offers? I mean, there are stations here in Nashville that they only stream in MP3 at too low of a bit rate to sound good. And I'm thinking, hey, dudes, you know, get up with the program here, stream it either at a faster bit rate or stream additionally with one of the AAC variants that you can do at a lower bit rate and still sound pretty good. So anyway, that's what prompted my question about the MP3 thing. And let me get Chris's reaction real quickly, too. Chris, you guys still do stream in MP3 at BGO, right?
Believe it or not, we do have one. And I forget the reason behind it. It has some other to do with, what was it, audience in Europe? There was some wacky reason because we turned it off. And then all of a sudden we got these calls and emails. And they're the only ones. Yeah, it's a small group. And trust me, the audience for our format, very dedicated, very specific, or very particular, I should say, about what they want and how they want it, and that's why we still do it. But everything else we're running with AAC with much success.
Interesting. Okay. And I thought I just read recently that officially MP3 support from Fraunhofer is mm-hmm. done. That was within the last year or so, officially. And hey, my former boss, the founder of Telos, was the very first licensee of MP3 in the world. So we do have a love relationship with MP3. It's very nostalgic for us, but that was a long time ago in a small town in Germany, far, far away. So Sean, let's move over to HLS for a moment, this adaptive audio streaming, because like you, I think this is the future. This, instead of choosing a bitrate that is the lowest common denominator for what you think your audience can receive in typical conditions, whether it's, by cell phone, by Wi-Fi, by 4G, by 3G, whatever. Instead of, we better, stream at a slow bit rate so everybody can get us. HLS turns that on its head, and it lets the user's device decide what bit rate it's going to stream at. And the user doesn't have to think about it. The user doesn't have to, choose here for our high bitrate stream, choose here for our low. No. That's not part of it at all. You just hit one button on your player and you get the best bitrate available that your connection will handle. So Sean, that's why I like HLS. Tell me about your thoughts on HLS.
Yeah. So, HLS itself is a protocol that is going to be delivering the different, it can deliver the stream. And then in addition to that, you can add the adaptive bit rate. And then at that point, it is up to the client, the app or the software that is going to be decoding it that needs to figure out which bit rate it's going to use out of those. And it can always be changing, going from a higher and a lower bit rate, depending on, if I'm driving and I hit a bad area. So it could adapt down to a lower bit rate and it can go up to a higher. And say in the video world, they can have, like a high quality HD video that they're trying to deliver. And then they could offer different variants of it. And then if it goes to mobile, that it just drops down to audio only. There's a lot of cool features there with the adaptive bitrate. Mm-hmm.
So tell me about CDNs that I happen to be, my stations are on a CDN that does not support HTTP live streaming or, HLS or adaptive bitrate. You guys, I believe, do support adaptive bitrate streaming. And do you see this expanding with different CDNs?
I do see it, HLS being used more and more, and even with that now, HLS is starting to catch on. We have MPEG Dash, which is a new method. It's an active player adoption, and it is a better way of doing it. But everybody is. A lot of people are still in the HLS world, and I do see more and more people taking that on.
It just sounds so better.
So what Sean's referring to, at least this is my view from the Telos world, is there are three main standards for adaptive bitrate streaming. And one is HLS that Apple has promoted. It stands for HTTP Live Streaming, HLS. There's Microsoft Smooth Streaming, and then there's MPEG Dash. And hey, we had a guest on our show a couple of years ago who works for Facebook or Google. I forget which of the time she's had both, but they use MPEG Dash. I know for backhaul and then I think out to their clients, which they have control over the client software. At least a year ago, it was hard to find cell phone client software that would do HLS audio streaming. Adaptive streaming is built right into Netflix and YouTube. When you watch a movie on Netflix, they stream it to you at the best bit rate that your player will do. And by the way, I did a whole chapter on adaptive bitrate streaming in my streaming university. And just so we don't recover it all here, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So if you're curious about how that works, I'll put that link in the show notes and you can review that if you like. But at its simplest, typically you have three different bit rates that are generated at the same time. A high bit rate. Hey, if you're on a wired connection, you might easily get 256 kilobits per second AAC, or even better. But and you'll get at least that. and you'll get a medium bit rate, maybe 96 kilobits per second AAC. And then you could have a low bit rate, even as low as like 16 kilobit per second XHE AAC, which can actually work down to that kind of bit rate. And then your player, there's different ways to design the player, but your player will decide which bit rate it can get. And it downloads typically 5 second chunks at a time, maybe 10 second chunks, depending on how the player's designed. But it'll, you know, download chunks of this at a time. And if it sees, hey, it's taking, 6 seconds to download a 5 second chunk, I better ask for a lower bit rate. Then it'll do that. And then on the other hand, if it says, hey, I'm only taking 2/100ths of a second to download 5 seconds worth of audio, let's see if there's a higher bit rate that I can go to here. So that's the idea. And your player in your phone becomes smart. And you don't have to worry about it, and you get the best bit rate. And just like Rocky said, it can sound super good because you can get a really high bit rate that otherwise wouldn't be available to you. Sean, Rocky, have I got that story at least partway straight?
Oh, yeah, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think that the biggest challenge with HLS is just, like we said, it's client adoption. We say client, that's player adoption. And I think that, you know, a lot of major broadcasters have been using it for a while. I know iHeart's been using it on their iHeartRadio app for, at least a couple of years. I think that the reason why you've seen a large adoption is that a lot of the largest ecosystems use it because they own the client. Like a Pandora or a Spotify or a higher rate or even a Tune. I don't know, does TuneIn do
TuneIn's, last I looked, it supported it in the mobile.
Yes. So, but not on desktop. Exactly. So you're starting to see that type of adoption starting to happen. And we're just all about continuing to push it. So it's just because it's just more efficient from a CDN standpoint. It costs the publisher less or the broadcaster less money, and it sounds better. And all of our apps support it. So we're there to do the push too.
Oh, that's awesome. Chris Tobin, your thoughts on adaptive streaming? Where's that going for broadcasters? Oh, we got Chris's. He had to take a phone call. He's doing support. That's all right. Hey, tell you what, Rocky and Sean, tell you what, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to hear from my employer, the TELUS Alliance. We're going to hear an ad that I did for a terrific streaming encoder, and we'll be right back with some final thoughts. And also, I'm going to get Rocky to explain a few of these terms that, as engineers, we need to at least be familiar with as we sit at the table with the other folks from the radio station and making our plans to either adopt or improve our streaming strategy. So we'll check into that right after this.
Streaming audio, it's everywhere and growing day by day. Connected cars and smartphones make your streaming availability more critical than ever. Now upgrade your streaming to no hassle clarity, stream reliability, and more revenue opportunities. Meet the ZipStream R2 and stream like you mean it. The ZipStream R2 is a professional streaming appliance with dual hot swap power supplies, dual audio inputs, dual network jacks, and critical server architecture. Reliability is built in. It's a world-class transmitter for your internet audio, designed from input to output for perfect streaming audio. The ZipStream R2 begins with both AES digital as well as Livewire IP audio inputs. Next is Omdia's famous AX 3-band audio processing, designed for jaw-dropping coded streaming audio. With optional Omdia 9 audio processing, you get Leif Claesson's undo and declipping technology. Undo corrects overprocessed source material, while the declipper actually restores clipped audio peaks. Omdia 9 includes a 3-stage AGC, sidechain EQ, plus program-dependent multi-band compression and look-ahead limiting. After audio processing, the ZipStream R2 encodes your streams. Choose from legacy MP3 or AAC and popular AAC family members like HEAAC V2. You even get the amazing new XHEAAC codec. All coding algorithms use fully licensed reference code for absolute premium sound and worldwide compatibility. ZipStream R2 includes adaptive multi-rate streaming for both Apple HLS and Microsoft Smooth Streaming. With adaptive streaming, your listeners automatically hear the highest bit rate their connection supports, even when it changes moment by moment. It keeps audio flowing automatically. Rack space is tight these days. In just one rack unit, the ZipStream R2 gives you audio processing and stream encoding for up to 8 stereo program channels. Each program channel can be processed and encoded up to 8 different ways. What's more, each encoder can then output multiple server feeds for diversity and redundancy. ZipStream R2 gives you powerful remote control via HTML5 and RESTful API. Plus, SNMP is fully supported. The feature list continues with Triton protocol integration, 5-year warranty, one-stop support, and comprehensive metadata formatting. Stream like you mean it with ZipStream R2 from the Telos Alliance.
And I want to thank the Telos Alliance for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. I certainly appreciate them doing so. And how fortuitous. We put a ZipStream R2 ad into this episode where we're learning about streaming. So Rocky, in some of our remaining moments, and while Sean is thinking of our tip of the week, a nugget that we just can't do without, Rocky, so there's some terms that if I sit down with a station owner and program director and maybe a representative from a company like yours, I got to understand, what the heck does programmatic mean? And what is ad insertion versus replacement? What is music licensing or something that is, you know, putting something online, maybe in social media that's licensed or non-licensed? Help me understand some of these things. Give me a primer here.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go ahead and start with the difference between ad insertion and ad replacement. Ad replacement is typically what we do for simulcast stations. That means that there is a hard spot set that needs to have ads replaced. And then that is why they're usually here. We ask for promo or promotional announcement underfill. And that's the other reason why programmatic is kind of nice, because then you don't hear those promos so much. We used to always say, oh, if I hear another Smokey, you know, the ad council Smokey Bandit ad, we're all going to like lose it. But that's one reason. So ad replacement means you have a hard spot and we're replacing ads. Ad insertion is a little bit different. That means that's typically more on podcasts. That's where it's either an on-demand product or something where it is not linear. So we'll put the metadata marker, and then we will go ahead and insert ads up to a certain event, like a spot break time. If there's no ads, say there's only 1 minute of ads, we'll play 1 minute. If there's no ads, then we'll actually roll over and not insert any ads at all if we want that. So those are the difference between ad insertion and ad replacement. Replacement is typically for linear simulcast. Ad insertion is typically for on-demand products where you don't have such a time factor. So I did mention programmatic a couple times. So really all programmatic is it's very simple. It's really the electronic exchange of advertising and buying advertising. So instead of the old days where you'd have a fax machine or the buyer sending over an ad insertion, an IO insertion order, and then trafficking it, what programmatic does, it automates all these processes. So now the advertiser will create the campaign on their side. They'll say that I want to buy it. And typically, there's a couple ways you can look at programmatic. I would say the most popular right now in digital audio is buying audience and not necessarily buying stations, although you can absolutely buy stations directly on programmatic channels as well. But they might be saying, I want to buy males 25-54 in Nashville that listen to rock stations or rock format. So that can be a total parameter that the advertiser then inserts on their side in their own platform. And then it comes over to our side and reaches our platform, which is called the supply side platform. And then we're able to then insert the ads on the right stations that meet those parameters. So, or even to the individual listeners, if that's what they want. So that's all programmatic is. It's just it's electronic transfer instead of doing the old insertion orders in email or via the old school way.
Wow. Okay. I think I'm starting to wrap my head around that. By the way, you've a couple times alluded to if I'm an advertiser, can I actually target can I target ads to individuals? Maybe ask it a different way. Can a CDN that's doing ad insertion, can you insert one ad for listener A and a different ad for listener B, or is it all going to be the same ad to all the listeners at that moment?
No, that's all dynamic. So everybody gets a different ad.
Yeah, everyone gets a different ad. And
they can get the same ad, but it's can still be targeted to them. So we can target, say, a state. You can target a city, the DMA.
Metros versus, because there's a difference between metros and geos, as you know, because digital uses a different type of census data to form like a DMA. But we also have CMAs for Canada. We have metros, Nielsen-based metros that we can target to, zip code.
First-party data that they can provide, say they ask for certain information. We could target that from that player. We can target user agents. That's the unique identifier of software or from a device.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they're even targeting an IP.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty crazy. It is very Minority Report. I'm targeting you right now, Kurt. You didn't notice. But yeah, it's very, very granular. But the problem is, I'll tell you the flip side of that though, Kurt, is that I've seen digital buyers target themselves out of a good reach in a buy.
Yeah.
So what happens is that you're like, oh yeah, this is great. Then all of a sudden they keep targeting. And now you don't have enough reach, and I'm still a frequency of 3 girl. So you need to have enough frequency and reach for a buy to be successful. I mean, that's the same on digital audio as it is on over-the-air radio. So I still think you have those type of elements in there. But I think that what the engineers are going to hear mostly in their Monday morning meetings from like the managers meeting is that we want to start, if they're not doing ad insertion already, they're going to be asked to start doing ad insertion. And I think that you're going to hear, well, we're going to start participating in, hopefully Empire Audience Network, or you have AdWave, or even have A2X. There are ad networks out there. And what that does is it's really helped them monetize what their direct sellers maybe might not be monetizing. I mean, I hate to use the R word, which is remnant, because that's has a very kind of like low value type of idea to it. Actually, digital audio has a very high value right now. It's, there for years, the fact that radio was a passive medium was such like kind of like was, we didn't like to talk about it in radio. And I always like to say audio has we have no competitors. I mean, we're a visually overstimulated society between like, video and like all of the apps and TV, radio has no competitors. It's the passive media is the fact that that's why it's making it strong. That's what it's making Alexa great. That's what's making everything. We're seeing an audio renaissance and a radio renaissance right now. It's really a very exciting time to be in the industry.
Wow. This targeting just boggles my mind. So it sounds like not that everyone does or not that it's common practice yet, but are you telling me that if I search for binoculars on Amazon, I might hear a binocular ad and just for me
Kurt, yeah, it's called retargeting technology. It was something that we developed at AdsWiz, and that, like I said, Empire Streaming as a reseller of AdsWiz, so we have all that entire stack to offer our clients as well. So it's, yeah, you're absolutely right. It is down to that level. I will tell you the challenges is that 5, 6, 7 years ago, we didn't have the scale, the reach to target you as a binocular person. But now that there's enough scale in the industry, digital audio as a whole, there's enough binocular people where an advertiser might actually want to go ahead and do that retargeting type of brand buy. But yeah, we can actually, if you go to a binocular site, we can retarget you a binocular ad, and that's actually a product of AdsWiz today.
Wow. I you know what? I'm going to get on my wife's computer and look at easy chairs and drones. That's what I'm going to look at. Yeah. And then she'll hear ads for easy chairs and drones.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's gotten very, it's very hard nowadays. There's so many different terminologies, and I really do try to bring it down. But I would say the other thing that engineers, so when they hear that, just when they're saying they're going to start participating in programmatic channels, it really doesn't change their job that much. That's more of a buying cycle. I think that the best thing I can offer, suggestions for engineers is that, metadata accuracy is really key.
Yes.
That I would say makes most of our life the hardest. Because a lot of folks, you might work with some providers that don't understand the concept of a dump button, or you hit that and it recycles everything, and then your metadata is shifted off. And we have a lot of experience with that because we just have deployed a lot of broadcasters over the years. So you definitely want to work with a provider that understands the ecosystem of a traditional radio station, because it is special. A lot of traditional radio stations use gains, and they use a lot of processing that also can do weird things that if you don't work with the provider, doesn't understand it, you're going to get a little bit of a not great sounding product, or you're going to have metadata problems on the insertion because it's going to start overlapping your ads. And that just doesn't sound good.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Chris, are you back? Are you off? What, are you off supporting somebody?
Yeah, it was family call.
Oh, God. Family comes first. So Chris, you've overheard all this, and my goodness, you're in a market where this is just where streaming and getting it right, I would think matters more, that the dollars are bigger, but it's also, you know, it's getting important to little guys like me. What are some of your final thoughts? And if you have any final questions for Rocky and Sean.
I have no questions. They've answered everyone. I had some notes here I was going to ask, but they went over it, so it's perfect. As far as the targeting or retargeting, I've noticed it. I've purposely gone to sites and done things, and I've watched carefully the ads that come back on a few things I've been doing lately, and I'm like, oh, look at that. That is the most unique thing that I could have looked for, and it's actually showing up in places that doesn't have anything to do with it. It's all for me. This is good. So I've now set up another computer with a different set of information and digital assets, and it's no longer me, and it's just my reference machine for finding things. So I don't have to worry about me being tagged. But other than that, it's now is the time to start being creative. Rocky's right. You know, it's not just the data. It's not just things. You now need to take the audio, engage it. We have no competition. I mean, radio has no competition except itself. The idiots that don't understand that there's more to it than what we do. But yeah, I think this is a great time. I mean, heck, podcasts are growing, which is an audio device or some video, but the audio ones do more than the video at the moment. So it's great.
Rocky, Sean, glad that you've been here. And I shouldn't close the program before I ask you, do you have any tips or advice that you'd like to leave us with? You've given up so many of them. Yeah. Any final parting thoughts, though?
Okay, I got one. This is something that I'm sorry, because I'm a little bit of a radio historian. My message to a lot of the broadcasters out there is, remember, podcasting is basically Little Orphan Annie from 1940s. Okay, it's episodic storytelling. And we used to be really, really good at it, guys. Why are we not doing this? I mean, it kind of pains me a little bit. I mean, heck, it's where the average quarter hour comes from, okay? So why don't my message is, we have great storytellers and we have great people who want to tell stories. And then even get involved in podcasting. I know it's not linear. It's on demand. But we have to remind ourselves it's the consumption that it's the way of consuming. It's what we're seeing is that video online is becoming more like radio, meaning that you're seeing more linear with the sports and everything that's happening on a live simulcast. And we're starting to see audio going the way of video, becoming a little bit more on demand right now. That's okay. You can still support your brand in the market. Just be smart about it. Look around where you have what talent you have on your staff and get into podcasting. It's a great medium. It's our roots. It's where we got into soap operas. We're the ones who started doing personal endorsement advertising back in the 40s. So I suggest everyone go back to what we used to do really well.
Mm-hmm. Good advice. If people are interested in some of the things that you've talked about with your company, Media Creek, and your Live 365, Empire Streaming, and Abovecast, where should they go? Where do they find your services?
I guess a great, you can go either MediaCreek.net or EmpireStreaming.com. And then, of course, you can always ping either one of us on LinkedIn. We're more than happy to help out anybody in the industry.
And I'll put links to your services in the show notes on this program, so they'll get distributed everywhere that the program is. So.
Great. Thank you so much.
Rocky and Sean, thank you so much for spending an hour of your time with us and the prep time as well. Chris Tobin, thank you for being here as well and asking your questions. Glad you're here and understand that you may or may not be here next week, but I hope you are.
Okay. But I have I'm off to the Texaco Star Theater now to do some episodic radio. So recreate the War of the Worlds, the Mercury Theater. Oh, I'm sorry. Did I go back in time?
You know, one of my stations actually is heavily involved with episodic radio. We always wonder whether or not the morning man will show up on time. That's that's the theme for every morning show. and will he be sober? No, I'm just kidding. All right. Hey. That's a story at a lot of radio stations. Remember Dr. Johnny Fever? All right, folks, we got to go. Sean and Rocky, thanks so much. I'll have the links to their company in the show notes. Glad to see Live 365 coming back. I love the name, and I actually used Live 365 as an example in some of my early PowerPoints and keynote presentations for the Telos Alliance. So glad that's coming back. those will be relevant once again. All right, we got to go. Thanks a lot to Suncast, the producer of today's show. Appreciate you so much, Suncast, getting things going for us today. Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. Chris Tobin, of course, my co-host. Thanks a lot. And Rocky and Sean. I'm Kirk Harnack. We'll see you next week. We'll be live from Denver next week from the Bonneville stations on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.